Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of August 1st, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Starting in August and continuing through the duration of the summer, we will be interrupting our standard program format to bring you a special broadcast dedicated to the ongoing investigation by independent researchers into the attacks of September 11th, 2001. During the week, which marked the 10th anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks, popularly referred to as 9/11, experts and scientists from around the world gathered at Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada, to present new and established evidence that questions the official narrative of that event and how it happened. The evidence was directed to a distinguished panel of experts over a four-day period. What you are about to hear was originally recorded, mastered, and assembled in a single video disc entitled The Toronto Hearings on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception. More information on the DVD, including how to order your own copy, will be made available at the end of the hour. Lance DeHaven Smith is professor in the Reuben O. D. Askew School of Public Administration and Policy at Florida State University. A former president of the Florida Political Science Association, he's the author, co-author, or editor of 15 books on topics ranging from religion and political philosophy to Florida government and politics. He is the author of Conspiracy Theory in America, published this spring by University of Texas Press. In his September 8th presentation, he addressed what he calls State Crimes Against Democracy, or SCADs.
I define SCADs as concerted actions or inactions by government insiders intended to manipulate democratic processes and undermine popular sovereignty. All I did was looked at Iran-Contra, Watergate, Plamegate, the manipulation of intelligence to get us into the Iraq war. And I said, what would we call this? What should be the name of this phenomenon? And that's how I came up with this concept, State Crimes Against Democracy. It tells us a lot that we didn't have a name for it. These used to be called high crimes or treason, but those terms have lost currency. I want to say SCAD's not another name for conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories are allegations, suspicions. They're suspicions that public officials themselves do not endorse. And basically they're saying unless this is investigated and confirmed by an official study, then it's a conspiracy theory. The SCAD concept is a type of crime. The conspiracy theory is trying to get us not to talk about that type of crime, and that's what it amounts to. So by naming it, it's an important thing to name it in the sense that it gives us something to be specific about and talk about without being spurned and turned away by the conspiracy theory pejorative label. JFK, John Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy, both assassinated in the 60s. Both brothers, both assassinated while campaigning, both shot in the head. But nobody looked at that as a serial crime. Nobody said, in fact, we don't say Kennedy assassinations. We say the Kennedy assassination. And what that means is the President Kennedy. 9/11, we're looking at the events of 9/11. But we tend to not think of 9/11 as connected to the anthrax letter attacks. I call this incident-specific myopia. So it's a nearsightedness. I think of it as driven, we're like victims. We're like abuse victims. The shocking events are so overwhelming, they loom large in our minds, in our perceptions, and we can't see them as if we were above and looking at a bunch of them. We can only just see the one and then see the other. But it is the opposite of the way we think about most crimes. If there was a man who married a wealthy woman and the woman died of a freak accident, and then he married another wealthy woman and she died of a freak accident, we would say, this guy's killing his wives. We would certainly suspect that. We would interrogate him. We want to know, where were you when she died from the freak accident? It would be our automatic response. The TV shows on crime use this constantly. They will look for patterns in crimes to identify the suspect. It's just a normal thing. It's criminology 101. And yet when we look at elite political crimes, we see them one at a time. Even when there are obvious connections, like the Kennedy assassinations or the 2000 and 2004 elections. Why do we do that? Well, I mentioned part of it is the abuse syndrome. Part of it, there's just powerful norms that prevent us from suspecting it. The fact is the political class ostracizes anybody who says these things. The clearest example of these norms is the conspiracy theory label and how it operates. Now, what's so peculiar about the conspiracy theory label is it doesn't make any sense. Okay, the idea of conspiracy being an irrational belief, the idea in a conspiracy is a sound legal concept. We use it all the time. We prosecute gangsters in the United States for conspiring. Conspiracies happen. We know that. Iran-Contra, Watergate. So how can you have a concept that dismisses all conspiracies as improbable or impossible? It also doesn't make any sense. It's an unsubstantiated theory of its own. When people dismiss conspiracy theories, what they're doing is embracing a coincidence theory. They're assuming that all these things, yeah, they didn't catch the hijackers getting on the planes, and yeah, there was a group of elites who said we needed to have a new Pearl Harbor, and yeah, there were all these war games going on at the time, and yeah, the buildings fell, all coincidental, all coincidences. So what's going on is you have an unsubstantiated theory that's being smuggled in with this pejorative term. And finally, it's based on a false premise. This idea that someone would talk, hey, Americans know you can keep secrets. We kept the Manhattan Project secret. That had 100,000 people working on it. They built three cities from scratch. One was the fifth largest city in Tennessee. This word never got out. Get this. When Truman became president, he was not told about the Manhattan Project until he had been in office for over a week. So we can keep secrets. We kept secret our decoding of the Japanese and German secret codes. That was kept secret all through the war. The idea that you can't keep secrets among large groups of people is just mistaken. All right, let's look at SCADs. I've got a list of 19 SCADs. These are political crimes and tragedies. Most are well documented. There are only a few that have been officially corroborated. Watergate, Iran-Contra, Plamegate. These SCADs, they're industrial level operations. If you look at Watergate, for example, this wasn't a couple of burglars. They had two people in the hotel across the street watching. They had one person to pick the locks. They had one person to photograph the documents. They had one person to wiretap the phones. They had a whole crew of people. And it was a, you know, highly organized operation. So the difficulty in convicting people on this is often they don't know what their role is. They know what they did, but they don't know where it fits in the larger scheme of things. If you look at the skills and tactics, they're skills and tactics of military and intelligence professionals. And actually, some other work I've done, if you look at the development of them, you'll see that they tend to correspond with what we're doing in the international sphere. So we have a series of assassinations in the 60s. Well, at the same time, we were assassinating leaders internationally. So my suspicion is that these tactics tend to migrate back in to our domestic affairs. If you look at Watergate, Iran-Contra, and Iraqgate, and just look at the trajectory of criminality, Watergate was basically a maniac, Nixon, wanting to get reelected. And he did implicate some other people and get them to go along with him, but they did reluctantly. participated in that. He hired the plumbers because the FBI would not wiretap the news media. So you have people saying they won't go along. When you get to Iran-Contra, now you've got a part of the military and a big chunk of the CIA implicated. When you get to Iraqgate, now we're talking the Justice Department with the torture memos and the preemptive war memos. You're talking big chunk of the military with its preemptive war and the CIA, of course. So it's becoming much more pervasive. I think it's a frightening trend. Last thing I want to mention, some things about 9/11. It fits the SCAD pattern. I'm just listing some SCAD characteristics. Intersection of presidential politics and foreign policy. Obviously, the 2000 election had undercut the legitimacy of the Bush presidency, and that was turned around after 9/11. It furthered the war on terror. It involves military and intelligence skills with aviation and demolition. The crime scenes were investigated superficially with the no check for explosives in the debris. The photographic evidence, the Pentagon, all the closed circuit TV videos were confiscated, and only one was released, which was a very poor quality. But there was also a set of photographs taken of 9/11, a helicopter flying above it. These photos did not come out until 2010. It took a Freedom of Information Act request through NIST to be able to get it. And they were really shocking because they showed so much dust and this kind of patterning that looks like explosives. There's a name for it, pyroclastic pattern. There's something peculiar about this label, 9/11. Now, this would have been a top priority for people. If somebody inside the government arranged this, they would want it to be framed in a certain way and would have been thinking about this. So I don't think this is out of the range of possibility. If it's a planted meme, it may have the characteristics of the conspiracy theory meme, which was empty. It's vague, but it's emotionally charged. It's a conveyance of emotion, and it's foreign to the culture. If we look at 9/11, it's emotionally charged. It's connected to the emergency phone number, 911. I mean, that itself is very suspicious. And I think that that's the connection that if this was designed, was intended to do, and that it may have been time to be on that date to have that connection. 9/11 deviates from our naming conventions. We don't name holidays and events, frightening events, by the date. The only date I can think of that we have in America for a special date is July the 4th. But even that is Independence Day. Normally, we would name where the event happened, so Pearl Harbor, Three Mile Island, or how it was done. So the anthrax letter attacks, for example, if we use that way of naming, we would call 9/11 the hijacked airplane attacks. The problem with using 9/11 is it elevates the historical significance of the event. There's before 9/11 and there's after. And it immediately conveys this way of thinking. These are the kind of sciences I think we should try to expand. I've given you examples of them. I hope that you'll join with me in doing these, and I appreciate everybody letting me use all their material for my theorizing. Thank you.
David Ray Griffin is a retired professor of philosophy of religion and theology from the Claremont School of Theology in Claremont, California. He has written or contributed to 12 books relating to 9/11, including his most recent 9/11 10 Years Later, When State Crimes Against Democracy Succeed. Here he is speaking on day one of the 10th anniversary hearings on the topic of the inadequacies of the 9/11 Commission Report.
By anomalies, I mean features about and in this report that would not be expected on the assumption that the official account of 9/11 is true and the commission was a truth-seeking body. After the 9/11 attacks, one might have expected the U.S. Senate to have had an investigation or hearings analogous to the Senate's Watergate hearings to determine who was responsible for the attacks. But the Senate Majority Leader, Tom Daschle, acquiesced to an appeal by President Bush and Vice President Cheney that only the House and Senate Intelligence Committees look into the potential breakdowns among federal agencies that could have allowed the terrorist attacks to occur, rather than a broader inquiry that some leaders have proposed. Bush and Cheney made this request, they said, because a broader inquiry would take sources and personnel away from the war on terror. So the resulting joint inquiry, authorized in February 2002, did not inquire as to who was responsible for the attacks, but simply presupposed the truth of the claims made by the Bush-Cheney administration. There were continuing signs that the Bush administration did not want the truth about 9/11 to be discussed. I will cite five pieces of evidence. First, Bush appointed Henry Kissinger to head the 9/11 commission, leading the New York Times to ask whether this was not a clever maneuver by the White House to contain an investigation it long opposed. When Kissinger had to resign because he refused to name his clients, Bush appointed former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane, who had no experience with Washington and national issues, and Representative Lee Hamilton, who had previously served as a Democrat covering up a Republican crime, and who had become friends with Cheney. The Bush White House also managed to get Philip Zelikow, a close friend of Condoleezza Rice, appointed as the executive director. Three, Bush promised only $3 million for the commission, whereas Ken Starr's investigation of President Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky had cost almost $30 million. In March of 2003, the commission asked for an additional $11 million, but the Bush administration turned the request down. Eventually, the commission was given $15 million. Five, having declared that the commission must finish its work by May 2004, the Bush administration delayed authority clearances for some of the commissioners. Commissioner Max Cleland said, "The White House wants to run out the clock here," with the result that the commission would not begin work until the middle of 2003, leaving it with less than a year to finish its work. The Bush administration later did allow for a few more months. In their preface to the 9/11 Commission report, Kane and Hamilton said that the commission sought to provide the fullest possible account of the events surrounding 9/11. In truth, the report provided was a fairly complete report of all the events surrounding 9/11 that could be used to support the official account of the 9/11 attacks. Evidence that some of the alleged hijackers, including Waleed al-Shiri, said to have been on American Flight 11, which supposedly struck the World Trade Center's North Tower, were still alive after 9/11. The Associated Press reported that al-Shiri spoke on September 22nd to the U.S. Embassy in Morocco, explaining that he lived in Casablanca, working as a pilot for Royal Air Maroc. Defenders of the official account would later claim that this was a case of mistaken identity. But a 2001 BBC article entitled "Hijacked Suspect Alive in Morocco" made clear that the man of that name identified by the FBI as one of the hijackers was still alive. His photograph was released by the FBI and has been shown in newspapers and on television around the world. That same Mr. Al-Shiri has turned up in Morocco, proving clearly that he was not a member of the suicide attack. He told Saudi journalists in Casablanca that he has now been investigated by the American authorities, who apologize for the misunderstanding. Nevertheless, the 9/11 Commission, writing as if none of this discussion occurred, endorsed the FBI's inclusion of Al-Shiri with his photograph on the list of hijackers. The commission even said that Al-Shiri was probably responsible for stabbing one of the flight attendants on American 11. The first page of the 9/11 Commission report says, among the air travelers on September 11 were Muhammad Atta and Abdul Aziz Al-Omari, who arrived at the airport in Portland, Maine. Atta and Omari boarded a 6 a.m. flight from Portland to Boston's Logan International Airport. This story raises puzzling questions. Why was Atta in Portland the morning of the attacks? Atta was not only purportedly the ringleader of the hijackers, but also the one assigned to be the pilot for American 11 after it was taken over. If the commuter flight had been delayed for an hour, as my flight was yesterday, he would have been too late to make the connection to American 11, just as I missed my connection yesterday. Why would he have taken such a risk? Both the 9/11 Commission and the FBI admitted that they had no answer to this question. According to the official story, in any case, Otto was already in Boston on September 11th, but then took a rental car, a Nissan Altima, to South Portland, stayed overnight at the Comfort Inn, and then got to the jetport in time to catch the 6 a.m. flight to Boston. Although Atta caught the American 11 flight, his luggage did not make it. And after the attack on the North Tower, his luggage at the Boston airport was opened, which contained much evidence, including Atta's will, that seemed to prove that the attacks had been carried out by Al-Qaeda. At least if one did not ask why Atta would have taken his will on a plane that he planned to crash into the World Trade Center. Stories in the mainstream press, including Newsweek and the San Francisco Chronicle, had reported that Muhammad Atta had engaged in behavior that undermined the portrayal of him as a devout Muslim, behavior such as gambling, drinking alcohol, and enjoying lap dances. These reports were even pointed out in a Wall Street Journal editorial entitled Terrorist Stag Parties, which said several of the hijackers, including reputed ringleader Muhammad Atta, spent $200 to $300 each on lap dances in the Pink Pony Strip Club. Moreover, investigative reporter Daniel Hopsicker reported that while Atta was in Florida, he used cocaine and lived with a stripper. The 9/11 Commission report, however, does not mention any of these reports. It instead portrays Atta as not only religious, but even fanatically so. According to Professor Dietmar Makuli of Hamburg, who had been Atta's thesis advisor supervisor in the 1990s, Atta's full name, like his father's, was Muhammad al-Amir Atta. And this young man was actually very religious. So much so that he prayed regularly, never touched alcohol, and would not even shake hands with a woman upon being introduced. Professor Makuli said, I would put my hand on the fire that this Muhammad al-Amir I know will never taste or touch alcohol. The Muhammad al-Amir Atta that the professor knew was also described by him as very small, being 1 meter 62 in height, which means slightly under 5 foot four, whereas the American Atta has been described as 5'8 and even 5'10. The 9/11 Commission never raised the possibility that the alcohol-drinking, cocaine-taking, lap-dancer-paying man going as Muhammad Atta was a different man than the devout Muslim student in Hamburg. With regard to the official account of the Twin Towers, the Commission ignored all of the problems, such as how fire could have caused steel frame buildings to have collapsed, especially straight down, totally, and in virtual free fall, and also how ordinary building fires, even if ignited by jet fuel, could have caused steel to melt. But the most anomalous omission about the World Trade Center was the fact that the Commission did not even mention the fact that World Trade Center 7, which was not hit by a plane, also came down totally. Amazingly, Hamilton evidently did not even know that his report did not mention World Trade Center 7. This fact was revealed in an interview of Hamilton by Evan Solomon of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which went like this. Solomon, why didn't the commission deal with the collapse of Building 7, which some call the smoking gun? Hamilton, well, of course, we did deal with it. Then after the conversation had shifted to other topics, Solomon brought it back to this, saying, I just want to clarify something that you said earlier. You said that the commission report did mention the World Trade Center 7, Building 7 in it. It did mention it or it didn't? Hamilton, the commission reviewed the question of the Building 7 collapse. I don't know specifically if it's in the report. I don't recall that it is, but it is. Solomon, I don't think it was in the report. Hamilton, okay, then I'll accept your word for it. The 9/11 Commission also omitted the fact that the Project for the New American Century, many members of which had become key members in the Bush administration, published a document in late 2000 saying that a new Pearl Harbor would aid PNAC's goal of obtaining funding for a rapid technological transformation of the U.S. military. The report headed by Zelikow, who had written NSA 2002, providing justification for attacking Iraq, omitted the fact that some key members of the Bush administration, including Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz, had been agitating for a war with Iraq for many years. It also omitted the notes of Rumsfeld's conversations on 9/11 showing that he was determined to use the attacks as a pretext for a war with Iraq. The commission endorsed the claim of Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, that he was in his office talking with a CIA briefer during the 9/11 attacks until the Pentagon was hit. But the commission failed to point out the contradictory account of counterterrorism coordinator Richard Clark, who said that Rumsfeld was in the Pentagon's video conference center participating in Clark's video conference. In fact, this is one of the most amazing things. Clark's book came out while the 9/11 Commission hearings were going. It became a national bestseller. Clark's book is never mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. The Commission also endorsed the claim of General Richard Myers, the acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that he was on Capitol Hill during the attacks that morning. But the Commission failed to point out that the contradictory account by counterterrorism coordinator Richard Clark, according to whom Myers was in the Pentagon participating in Clark's video conference. Rather dramatic contradictions. Conclusions. The points in the first part of this paper provide reasons to suspect the 9/11 Commission report to be untrustworthy. The points in the second part provide illustrations of the fact that this Zelikow report is indeed untrustworthy. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a special summer broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on participating community radio stations across Canada. We are also heard on the Progressive Radio Network and our podcast at globalresearch.ca. Kevin Ryan is a chemist and laboratory manager and the site manager for Environmental Health Laboratories, a division of Underwriters Laboratories, before he was fired in 2004 for publicly questioning the report being drafted by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, on their World Trade Center investigation. He has continued to research the World Trade Center attacks and works as co-editor of the online Journal of 9/11 Studies. In his presentation at Ryerson, he discusses the inadequacies of the NIST reports.
Today I will discuss evidence related to the official investigations conducted by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, whose reports comprise the final official explanation for what happened at the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Before we get to the reports, however, let me mention that the first pertinent point to consider is the low probability that the only three instances of a skyscraper suffering global collapse due to fire occurred all on the same day in the same place. There have been many raging building fires, much worse than existed in any of the World Trade Center buildings, but no global collapse has ever resulted from those fires. The U.S. government has told us that it was the fire that destroyed all three buildings at the World Trade Center. We can see from these photos that the towers appeared to have exploded, starting at the top and then going all the way down. Also, high-velocity bursts of debris shot out from 10 to 30 floors below the collapsed front. At the top of each tower, the debris appeared to shoot upward and outward as much of the solid structure turned to dust. This is counterintuitive to the idea that the building was being crushed downward. Some large steel column assemblies were shot outward for hundreds of feet. Many of us have asked ourselves, is this what it looks like when a building is softened or weakened from fire? NIST made the point that in no instance did they report that steel in the World Trade Center towers melted due to the fires. The melting point of steel is about 1,500 degrees Celsius. Normal building fires and hydrocarbon fires generate temperatures much lower than that. NIST reported maximum upper layer air temperatures, that's air temperatures, of only about 1,000 degrees Celsius. In other words, diffuse hydrocarbon fires such as these cannot produce temperatures high enough to melt steel. Unfortunately, many prominent media and political figures have suggested that very thing and continue to do so. The fire resistance of tall buildings like those at the World Trade Center is ensured through testing of samples prior to construction. My former employer, Underwriters Laboratories, tested and certified the fireproofing used in the World Trade Center towers, as seen in this quote from the company that manufactured the fireproofing. UL tested the steel components used in the World Trade Center towers to meet the 1968 New York City Fire Code. That meant that the column assemblies had to withstand 3 hours of intense fire, and the floor assemblies had to withstand 2 hours of intense fire in a test furnace. And of course, the biggest problem with this is that one of the towers failed in 56 minutes. Here's the fellow that told me about this testing, Loring Knobloch, who was the CEO when I worked there. He later wrote to me and a few others saying, we tested the steel with all the required fireproofing on it, and it did beautifully. As we do not do follow-up service on this kind of product, we can give only an opinion on the test sample, which was indeed properly coded, and we tested the code requirements, and the steel clearly met those requirements and exceeded them. And as I said, UL later participated in the NIST World Trade Center investigation, which was a clear conflict of interest. A question NIST tried to answer was, how could the World Trade Center towers collapse in only 11 seconds and 9 seconds, speeds that approximate that of a ball dropped from a similar height in a vacuum? And we independent investigators agree that the buildings came down essentially in free fall, and this is an important starting point. This violates two fundamental laws of physics, one being the law of conservation of momentum, and another being the law of conservation of energy. The first law means that hundreds of thousands of tons of material in the cold lower section should have slowed the upper part of the building simply due to the mass of the lower section. The second law requires that deformation of the lower section would consume energy, slowing the fall even more. Another point of agreement among all parties is that the theory that was claimed to be the most probable root cause for many years, called the pancake theory, in which the floors pancake down upon each other, is no longer supported by NIST. It's really no longer supported by anyone. And since 2004, when my former company did test models of the floor assemblies, the pancake theory has no longer been viable. The NIST World Trade Center report is over 10,000 pages. It was originally published only for the towers in 2005, and like previous reports on the subject, it was focused only on the fire-induced collapse hypothesis. NIST made no real effort to examine the explosive demolition hypothesis. NIST's stated goals were to explain why and how World Trade Center buildings 1 and 2 collapsed after the initial impact of the aircraft, and why and how World Trade Center Building 7 collapsed. The scientific tests that NIST performed to reach its conclusions included tests to determine gas temperatures, tests to determine steel temperatures, tests to determine the possibility of floor failure, tests to determine the possibility of fireproofing loss. Unfortunately for NIST, none of the tests it performed supported its conclusions, as we will see. NIST therefore based its entire explanation on computer models. A summary of what NIST found was as follows. The aircraft severed columns, loads were redistributed, fireproofing was widely dislodged, high temperatures weakened columns and floors, floors began to sag, sagging floors pulled exterior columns inward, causing them to buckle. Instability spread around the entire building, and then they simply said global collapse ensued. We'll examine each of these steps. The first step in this sequence was that columns were severed. Again, it's agreed that the core columns were massive and over-designed, and the perimeter columns were made of super strong steel. But NIST now admits that 14 to 15% of the columns were severed in the World Trade Center towers. This is compared to original design claims published in the Engineering News Record when the buildings were first announced. They said that one could cut away all the first-story columns on one side of the building and partway from the corners of the perpendicular sides, and the building could still withstand design live loads and a 100-mile-per-hour wind from any direction. What that means, in essence, is that the towers could lose 25% of their columns, and they'd only lost 14 to 15%. The second step in this sequence was that the gravitational load was redistributed among the remaining columns. NIST said that loads on some columns were decreased, and on other columns they were increased up to 25%. Again, original design claims said that live loads on these perimeter columns can be increased more than 2,000% before failure occurs. The third very critical step in this sequence was that fireproofing was, quote, widely dislodged. NIST said the towers would not have collapsed under the combined effects of aircraft impact and the subsequent multi-floor fires if the insulation had not been widely dislodged or had been only minimally dislodged by airliner impact. As said before, the steel structure was covered with a spray-applied fireproofing material. There were requirements for the fireproofing to have a certain bond strength, and those requirements were met. In the center and right photo below, you can see how the fireproofing was applied to the columns and underneath the floor assemblies. The test that NIST performed to establish the critical fireproofing loss involved a total of 15 rounds from a shotgun at steel plates and bars. Here you can see photos from the NIST report of the results of these tests. But NIST did not explain how a Boeing 757 airliner could be converted into many thousands of shotgun blasts, which would need to be pointed in all directions to shear off the fireproofing. A real serious problem with this is NIST provided to us the energy requirements, and too much energy is required for this. Previous calculations by engineers at MIT had shown that all the kinetic energy available from the aircraft impact was consumed in breaking the columns, crushing the floors, destroying the aircraft. And NIST had tests that showed that 1 megajoule was required for every square meter of surface to shear off the fireproofing via this shotgun blast effect. That's more than 6,000 square meters of column, floor deck, and floor joist surface, according to the NIST report. That would be several times more than the entire kinetic energy available from the aircraft impact. The plane hit the building, fires rose up. NIST says the fires died down. Explosions do that. They consume the oxygen. And then over time, the fires rose up again and began migrating around the core of the building. It took a whole hour for that to happen, leaving 45 minutes of fire time at the south wall. Now, NIST claimed that the south wall then bowed inward from the fires there. But we might ask why the east and west walls, which had seen as much fire time, why they didn't show any bowing. My former company, UL, participated in the NIST investigation by conducting tests on models of World Trade Center floor assemblies to examine the floor response to fire. The result was that only very slight sagging occurred in the tests and no collapse. After 45 minutes in a high-temperature furnace, all four test models sagged only about 3 inches in the middle, and the major joist parts did not sag at all. NIST computer model turned this into 42 inches of sagging with the joist bending down severely. Here's a photo of one of those floor assemblies after the standard method ASTM E119 was performed. During this test, it was held in a furnace at a temperature over 1,000 degrees Celsius for a period of 2 hours. You can see the slight effect. The midsections of the assembly sagged a few inches, but the frame was not damaged and the floor held its load without failure. The weight loaded was twice as great as what was known to have existed in the World Trade Center. These experiments were performed on 4 separate floor models, all of which had less fireproofing than was known to have existed in the World Trade Center on September 11th. If the sagging had been severe, as in the computer model, what would have to happen to make the sagging floors create these dramatic pull-in forces as NIST requires? Sagging floors, for one thing, do not weigh any more than unsagged floors. But to defeat the original design claims, over 30 columns would have to be pulled in. And the floors were known to form this intense staggered grid with the columns, the way it was constructed. And the force required to pull a perimeter column inward within that grid and overcome that was far greater than what a sagging floor assembly could provide. Even within NIST computer models, the sagging and pulling effects that NIST explanation depends on were not seen. Not even for the most severe cases examined. Here are several quotes from the NIST report that make that fact clear. Sagging of floors in such a wide range over fire floors was not predicted by full floor model analysis. Locations and magnitudes of pull-in forces were not accurately simulated. Pull-in forces were applied in some locations where the full floor analyses did not predict the development of such behavior. NIST was simply not able to demonstrate this critical pull-in effect. Physical tests were not done, although that would have been decisive. The computer models did not indicate these forces either. And as a result, NIST made some fraudulent changes to the scenario. All the fireproofing was stripped off a large section of the computer modeled building and exaggerated temperatures were applied for twice as long as NIST had said occurred in the failure zones. That is, they applied exaggerated temperatures for 90 minutes instead of 45 minutes. But even then, the pull-in forces were not created in the computer. So NIST did something completely paradoxical. It disconnected the floors before applying an imaginary pull-in force. This is the opposite of science. This is not anywhere near science. No physical test done. The computer models did not give them the answer they want. So they do something completely fraudulent, which is exactly what they did. The final step of NIST's sequence for the towers was that instability caused by the perimeter columns pulling inward spread around the entire perimeter of the building. This would be necessary to explain the perfectly uniform fall. Again, no tests of any kind were performed to confirm this instability spread. And for several reasons, it does not appear to be realistic. The buildings fell at near free fall acceleration, so the instability would have to fit within that time frame. If we give it only half a second of the time, then this instability spread is moving at nearly twice the speed of sound. That's not realistic. It's not shown in the photos. So finally, for the towers, the NIST report is false because NIST did not explain why and how the buildings collapsed, and the investigation was deceptive and unscientific. NIST reported findings that were in direct contradiction to the physical testing performed. This is what I was fired from my job for stating. NIST omitted or distorted many important facts. Now I would like to examine the NIST report for World Trade Center Building 7, the third building that collapsed on 9/11. This building was 47 stories tall, was not hit by a plane, and yet at 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11, it fell vertically and symmetrically in 6.5 seconds. After 7 years of waiting, NIST finally put out its official report on Building 7 in 2008. No one could have predicted the sequence of events that NIST says led to this building falling. It says that normal office fires caused fully fireproof steel beams to fail in one area of the building, and that's what led to this entire structure falling as it did into a neat rubble pile. If we were to accept this NIST World Trade Center Building 7 report, we would have to conclude that no tall buildings are safe from the possibility of total unexpected collapse due to office fires. The low probability hypothesis that FEMA described was that diesel fuel fires driven by diesel fuel tanks located within the building created intense fires that caused the collapse. And for years, NIST promoted that diesel fuel fires hypothesis as well, but NIST abandoned that hypothesis in its final report. NIST said diesel fuel fires did not play a role in the collapse of Building 7. NIST also suggested for years that the damage caused by falling debris from the North Tower was a root cause of the collapse of Building 7. Ultimately, NIST gave up on that hypothesis as well, saying other than initiating the fires in Building 7, the damage from the debris from North Tower 1 had little effect on initiating the collapse of Building 7. And contrary to some media reports, the building design was not an issue either. One serious problem was the destruction of evidence. The U.S. House Committee on Science reported that in the month that lapsed between the terrorist attacks and the deployment of the FEMA team, a significant amount of the steel debris was removed from the rubble pile, cut into smaller sections, and either melted at the recycling plant or shipped out of the U.S. Some of the critical pieces of steel were gone before the first FEMA team member ever reached the site. This is in violation to our national standard in the United States, at least, for fire investigations, which says that it is essential to prevent the destruction or removal of evidence. Another serious problem is that NIST was stumped for years. Now, they told us in 2006 that their lead investigator, Shyam Sunder, told New York Magazine that he didn't know. He's had trouble getting a handle on Building 7. There's a problem here because the new Building 7, which is taller, built in the same site, was completed in 2006. You would think they would want to know what happened to the first one. And 2 years later, they said they did know. They said it's no longer a mystery. The same man, Chaim Sunder, the lead investigator. It's all about science, and the obvious stares you in the face. So we'll take a look at NIST's final theory now and discover for ourselves whether or not it's obvious. But we should remember that it's entirely computer-based. NIST did no physical testing at all to support its Building 7 report. Here are the basics of the NIST explanation for what happened to Building 7. On the fact is, they're saying that fire-induced thermal expansion of the floor system surrounding Column 79 led to the collapse of Floor 13, which triggered a cascade of floor failures. In this case, the floor beams on the east side of the building expanded enough so that they pushed a girder spanning between two columns, and this caused the girder to walk off its seat. You'll see more in detail. But basically, this here in the lower left, you see a diagram of a beam from the NIST report pushing a girder off its seat. That caused the whole building essentially to collapse. An important point here, when we're talking about floors and the beams below them, is something called shear studs. The NIST interim report from 2004 said that most of the beams and the girders were made composite, or one piece, the floor and the beam, one piece with these studs. In a deceptive turnabout, in their final report, they said that no shear studs were installed on any of the girders. Unfortunately for NIST, it's just not just its own 2004 interim report that contradicted this vital aspect of the final theory. The presence of shear studs on all the girders was also described by John Salvarinas, the project manager for Building 7, from the company that supplied the steel components. This diagram from an academic paper that Salvarinas wrote in 1986 showed that there were 30 shear studs on that critical girder. And for the question about where column 79 is, right here. NIST claims that thermal expansion caused the breakage of over 100 bolts, high-strength bolts. The mechanism that NIST claims caused all this damage is called differential thermal expansion. This is when the expansion of the beam below is much greater than the expansion of the concrete's floor slab above it when they're both heated in a fire. Thermal expansion is not a new phenomenon, as NIST suggests, but has been a consideration throughout the history of structural design. You can see that point made here by two building professionals from Australia who wrote a response to NIST on its Building 7 report. These building professionals reported that they had actually done physical tests to see what thermal expansion would do to floor assemblies. These were just the kinds of tests that NIST should have done. Structural engineer Ron Brookman, a colleague of mine, made a FOIA request to NIST in 2009 asking for the calculations and analysis behind the claim of girder walk-off failures. NIST responded that the release of that information might jeopardize public safety. Because thermal expansion is a function of temperature, we need to know what temperature NIST says the beams reached so that we can estimate how much they expanded. This was a tricky question for NIST, because at temperatures as high as 600 degrees Celsius, the steel will lose some strength and stiffness, and therefore not be able to extend into the girder. At the same time, if the temperature is not high enough, there wouldn't be enough expansion of the beams. What NIST settled on was just in the area of the northeast corner of floor 12, the beam temperatures reached 400 degrees Celsius. On the lower part of this slide, you can see an example of just how tenuous NIST computer models were with respect to reality. NIST computer models had all the steel heating to extreme temperatures and all the bolts and other connections breaking within a matter of about 2 seconds. This is an example of how NIST computer modeling was not realistic. Once the temperature distribution for its theory was settled, NIST found a way to suggest that the differential thermal expansion could be possible, at least in the computer. They simply didn't heat the floor slab above. And this is what most scientists might call fraud. If you don't heat the floor slab, of course the beam's going to extend in differential expansion. Another thing NIST said was that there were seven-hour fires in Building 7, which gave the impression that the fires were very long and very hot. But early photographs did not show fires on floors 11 through 13, where NIST says the first failures occurred, until after 2 p.m. And the building fell less than 3.5 hours later. So there could not have been seven-hour fires in those areas. Underwriters Laboratories provided the fire resistance information for Building 7 as well. There were requirements for fire resistance of the columns and floor steel in Building 7, just as there is for any skyscraper. The requirements were that these steel components had to withstand 2 to 3 hours of intense fire in standard tests. Another problem that NIST did not explain is that the fires on floor 12 were completely burned out at least 30 minutes before the building fell, and it's well known that steel cools quickly after a source of heat is removed. At approximately 4 o'clock, NIST computer simulation shows raging fires across the north side windows of floor 12. The photo from the same time shows no fires in that area at all. There are significant problems with NIST's description of the collapse dynamics as well. One problem is that the computer model output does not match what we see in videos. As you can see here, NIST's computer model suggests the building crumpled from the sides before falling. Another problem is that NIST has admitted that Building 7 fell at free fall acceleration for a period of time, and that simply cannot occur without the structure below being removed by some unexplained forces. So finally, I would just say again that NIST produced World Trade Center reports that are false. They did not explain why and how the buildings collapsed, and the investigations were deceptive and unscientific. NIST reported findings that were in direct contradiction to the physical testing performed. NIST omitted or distorted many important facts. They will not share the results with the public, and therefore, an important point here, these results cannot be independently verified as required in science. And NIST explanations have not been taken seriously by the building construction community. So thank you.
On today's program, we've heard presentations from Professor Lance DeHaven Smith of Florida State University, David Ray Griffin, retired professor of philosophy, religion, and theology from the Claremont School of Theology, and former laboratory manager with Underwriters Laboratories, Kevin Ryan. Today's presentations are all from a 330-minute DVD entitled The Toronto Hearings on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception. You may order your own copy by visiting the website globalresearch.ca. The Toronto Hearings on 9/11, Uncovering 10 Years of Deception, was presented by the International Center for 9/11 Studies in collaboration with Press for Truth. It was produced by Stephen Davies, Dan Dix, and Brian Law. Music was by Dan Dix. The executive producer was James Gourley. Producer and host of the Global Research News Hour is me, Michael Welch. Thank you for joining us this week. Please be sure to listen to the show next week for part 2 of this special summer series.